You're listening to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast, but before we get started, I wanted to tell you about an exciting opportunity for you and the leaders you know this fall, the Pipeline Conference. Our team, the Lifeway Leadership Team, is hosting Pipeline on October 13 in Nashville. And it's a conference unlike others you've probably been to because it's a training conference, an event that will show you and your church leadership team how to launch a leadership pipeline. You'll hear from speakers such as Tom Rayner, Eric Geiger, Kerry Newhoff, and Paul Tripp. We'll have plenary sessions interspersed with shorter, practical TED-style talks. We'll have Q&As with the speakers to clarify and apply what was said, and we'll also offer a second day built around coaching and implementation that will have limited seating. And we really want you to join us. Go to myleadershippipeline.com to learn more and to register. Pricing is affordable, and we're offering an early bird discount through the end of July, so you want to move quickly. Again, go to myleadershippipeline.com for more information and to register. We look forward to seeing you there. Enjoy the podcast. Hey, and welcome to the 5 Leadership Questions podcast. This is your host, Barnabas Piper, here as usual with Todd Adkins, the Director of Leadership here at Lifeway.
What?
Today, we have the honor of asking our 5 leadership questions of Simon Sinek, who is a name you probably recognize if you've been around the leadership space, the TED Talk space, from his first book, which was Start With Why, which is sort of a seminal book on the purpose of an organization, of leadership. He had a second book called Leaders Eat Last, which is another fantastic leadership title. His TED Talk on the why, which is really the emphasis of Simon's organization and work and speaking and all of that, is, I think, the third most watched TED Talk of all time. So that's pretty significant. Simon, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So normally what we do after I give the brief bullet points of what a person does and what their highlights are is just to kick it over to our guests and let them introduce themselves. So a little bit about who you are, a little bit about your family, your present role, some of the things that help listeners know who it is we're talking with today.
I love what I do, right? I wake up every single morning with a very clear sense of purpose. It's to inspire people to do what inspires them. Mm-hmm. And I have a crystal clear vision of the world I want to live in. I can imagine a world in which the vast majority of people wake up every single morning, inspired to go to work, feel safe when they're there, and return home fulfilled at the end of the day. And so for me, the joy of the work that I do is figuring out all the ways to help advance that cause. And so, you know, even doing something like this is part of it. You know, it offers me a forum to share my ideas and share the vision and hopefully enroll others to join. I live in New York City and lived here for many years, but was not originally from here. Have a sort of a very cool upbringing. I was born in England. Mm-hmm. and lived all over the world, lived on 4 continents by the age of 10 years old, which is really a great way to grow up, to live, you know, in Africa and Asia and Europe. And really, it really imbued in me sort of a curiosity about people that aren't just like me. And I think that's contributed greatly to the work that I do.
How important is curiosity to leadership?
I think curiosity is everything, right? It's the underlying motivation to learn. It's a characteristic where you acknowledge you don't know everything and perhaps there's always better ways to do things. Mm-hmm. I'm always nervous of people who aren't curious about anything in the world. You know,
I don't understand them. Like, the world is such a fascinating place. It seems odd to not be curious about anything.
Non-curious people would not be listening to this interview.
So that means we can talk about them at will because they'll never know about it.
Exactly right.
So the first question we always ask, which I'm very happy to ask you, especially as we've already started talking about learning and curiosity, is who are you learning from right now?
There's a few people in my life that I turn to on a regular basis with questions about sort of how the world works. contemporaries and people who are way more experienced than me. One is a guy by the name of Bob Chapman. He's the CEO of a company called Barry Waymiller based in St. Louis, Missouri. And Bob has really built a company where the culture is unbelievable. They take care of each other and they care about each other. I've never seen anything like it. It's kind of amazing. The first time I ever visited the company, I went and visited a bunch of their factories And it's good old fashioned American manufacturing, blue collar, you know, it's really great stuff. Mm-hmm. And he asked me, what did I think at the end of the tour? And I said, I can no longer be accused of being a crazy idealist if what I imagine exists in reality. It's that good.
So, and so this, the company is not like some crazy out there entrepreneurial venture. It's just, it is a, what do they manufacture? It's just a sort of a normal blue collar mid-America company.
Yeah. They make large machines.
So oh, wow.
When Kimberly Clark needs a machine to make toilet paper, somebody has to make that the machine and they right. make it. And
oh,
all,
very cool.
Everything, all the workforce is domestic. Even when pressure from outside to send, labor, to Asia, for example, they've never done it. And yet they've remained competitive and very successful as a result. And it's because of their remarkable culture and just the way they choose to lead.
What is that? Like, how does Bob, and you said Bob Chapman's the gentleman's name. How does Bob lead in such a way that the culture is what it is?
He, if you ask him, what does the company do? He tells you, we make great people to do extraordinary things. So his whole framework for what the company, why the company exists is circles on the brilliant talents of the people around him. And he has simple philosophies like catch people doing things right instead of catching people doing things wrong, mm-hmm. you know, which is what we do in the rest of our companies.
Right.
And the demonstration of empathy. If somebody's performance is struggling, instead of sitting down with them and saying, listen, you got to pick up your numbers, you walk into their office and say, hey, is everything okay? You know, even the way they talk about their people. I mean, they've got 6,000 to 8,000 people working. So it's not like a small business.
Right.
And they don't use the word headcount. It doesn't exist anywhere in their vernacular. They use the word heart count. They will literally discuss the heart count of their company.
It's almost like an anti, trying to think. I mean, we are entering almost, different types of economies, of course, but we've come into, you know, what Joe Pine would say is an experience economy. But what I'm seeing is there's almost a stark contrast between that and everything else is becoming a commodity. And it sounds like it's almost anti-commodity because if they're building these from scratch each time they're asked to build a new machine, they have to figure out how to do that.
I mean, yes and no. From a product standpoint, I completely agree with you. But I think what's really interesting, and this follows on your thinking here, which is they're challenging the conventional wisdom of how to run a business in America today. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about it, most of the standard business philosophies that exist in America today are leftovers from the 1980s and 90s. You know, the 80s and 90s were boom years where everybody made money. And it was a time of relative peace with a kinder, gentler Cold War. And a lot of the theories on how to build a business being espoused back then were good for those times. So, for example, the concept of shareholder supremacy, where you put the wants, needs, and desires of your shareholders, even sometimes ahead of your customers and employees, that theory, that was first proposed in the late 1970s. The concept of using mass layoffs to balance the books did not exist in the United States prior to the 1980s. The whole idea of rank and yank, where you rank the performance of your people and the top 10% of people who contribute to the bottom line or the stock price are promoted and the bottom 10% is summarily fired, mm-hmm. that was a theory that was proposed and popularized by Jack Welch at General Electric. And the whole idea of creating internal competition, pitting your own people against each other, again, promoted by folks like Jack Welch. And quite frankly, those theories were good for those days and they were good short-term theories and they didn't last. And a lot of the things that our American economy is suffering today are a result of those theories. We still put shareholder supremacy first, even though everybody knows that it doesn't work. Like that's not news. You know, the idea of quarterly or annual over long-term growth, again, everybody knows that it's actually bad for long-term viability, but we still do it. And the fact that mass layoffs have become so normal that we don't even perceive them as destructive to a company is really unnerving. And so folks like Bob Chapman are challenging these conventional and outdated business philosophies head on and offering alternatives that, by the way, are way more profitable than the ways of Jack Welch. Remember, GE needed a $300 billion bailout in 2008. That's not a company built to last.
Yeah, not that we're counting or anything. but that is that's a big number.
That's a large number of taxpayer money.
So do you know if there's anything about Bob Chapman's, like, what is it about his background? I feel like we should go reach out to him and have him on the podcast next because he sounds tremendous. What is it about his background that led him to want to lead a company in that manner when culture just presents, the majority of options that culture presents look nothing like that?
Sure. So Bob was trained as an accountant, and he was, you know, and like most of the MBAs that exist in the world today, were never really taught leadership. They were taught management, mm-hmm. and they were taught to see human beings as line items rather than what they are, which is, you know, human beings with families and lives and emotions and everything. And he was one of those bad executives, and ran his business ruthlessly, and he had a couple of experiences which really, you know, changed his perspective. They really challenged his conventional wisdom. One of the stories that he's related to me was he bought a company. He bought a company somewhere, South Carolina, I think it was. And as the new CEO, he went to have a meeting. He went to visit with the team, and he was sitting there in the cafeteria early morning, getting himself a cup of coffee, and nobody knew who he was, right? Because he was the new owner, and he watched the excitement of the employees who were in the cafeteria with him as they were playing. They were sort of like looking at betting pools of March Madness, you know, and they were so excited and smiling and joking. And then as soon as the whistle rang for everybody to go to work, it's as if, you know,
like they turned off the happy,
like all the happy got turned off,
yeah.
And all of the body language sank and everybody sort of plodded to work, you know. And he couldn't understand why all of these passionate people, all of a sudden, all of the passion was sucked out of them simply at the when a whistle sounded, and he thought to himself, wouldn't it be amazing to create an environment where we can make work as fun as not work, and it's probably better for business, and it was where, and that was one of the experiences he had where he started trying new things and experimenting with how you change the culture so that people are passionate and love to come to work, because he just couldn't stand what he saw, you know. It really shook him.
Well, I think it's amazing how that he noticed it at all. I mean, it speaks back to the curiosity point we were making at the beginning. It takes a certain level of observation and what else is going on in the world, what else needs to go on to even observe that, because I think most people just kind of go, oh, that's just how things work.
Yeah.
The buzzer rings to start the next shift and everybody just sort of like the gloom descends and off we go. But he saw it as a challenge to be overcome and probably as an opportunity, it sounds like.
Yep. Yeah, exactly right.
Well, let's hit our second question. And that is, what is the main point of emphasis for your leadership right now? And that could be for leading yourself in personal growth or leading an organization, working with other organizations. I know you do a lot of things in terms of speaking and consulting and coaching. So what's the main point of emphasis in leadership for you right now?
So for me, leadership is a journey, right? And it is a never-ending journey. I will never be the leader I want to be, but I will die trying, you know? And so I think of myself as a student of leadership. Some people refer to me as an expert. I think that's ridiculous because I don't know everything there is to know. I may be a more advanced student than others, but I'm a student nonetheless. And so my own education, I'm continuing to learn about myself with introspection as a leader. I take counsel from my own team. I seek advice from others. And specifically the point I'm at in my journey. So all my work is semi-autobiographical, right? So Start With Why was born out of my need to rediscover my own passion. That was the birth of it. Leaders Eat Last was my attempt to understand the concepts of trust and cooperation, because I had some experiences where people, I thought they were my friends, and I realized they were just working me because they wanted something from me. And now the work that I'm fascinated by is game theory. You know, I'm an idealist, but I live in the real world. And so I have to reconcile that. You know, do I rage against the machine, or should I better understand the dynamics of idealism and short-termism? And so I'm fascinated these days with understanding, you know, how I operate in the real world and how my organization operates in the real world and how our idealistic vision operates in the real world.
So I'm going to take a moment to ask a very selfish question, because I'm not sure if anybody else wants to know this, but I want to know what are you reading, or what are you looking at for as far as game theory is concerned?
Oh, there's an amazing little book called Finite and Infinite Games by an NYU professor named James Carsey. You know, I can sum the whole book up if you want. It's really very simple. In game theory, there are two kinds of games. There are finite games and there are infinite games. A finite game is defined as known players, fixed rules, and agreed upon objective. So baseball, for example, we know what the rules are, we know who the players are, and we all agree that the game ends whoever has more runs at the end of 9 innings, right? Those are the rules. We've all agreed to them. Then you have an infinite game. An infinite game is defined as known and unknown players. The rules are changeable, and the objective is to keep the game in play. So when you pit a finite player versus a finite player, the system is stable. Baseball is stable. When you pit an infinite player versus an infinite player, the system is also stable. So like the Cold War was stable because there are no winners and losers, right? And that's the point. In an infinite contest, there are no winners and losers. Players simply drop out when they run out of the resources or the will to play. And problems arise when you pit a finite player versus an infinite player. Because finite players are playing to win, and infinite players are playing to continue the game. And so it's the difference between somebody who is driven by personal ambition versus somebody who's driven by idealism. Ambition is finite. Idealism is infinite.
Because one is based on achievement and the other is based on improvement?
One is based on advancing, improving and advancing. I'll give you another example. The game of business is infinite, right? Is it pre-existed every company that's on the planet today, and it will outlast every company that's on the planet today. However, if you look at the way most businesses function, they're operating as if they work in a finite game, right? They're playing to win or to be number one. And my question is, based on what agreed upon objective? Profit? Headcount? Square footage? Revenues? Nobody's agreed what the standards are, nor have we agreed on the timeframes. We're the number one company in X. Based on what? 5 years? 10 years? 50 years? Like, we haven't agreed to the rules. So inherently, they're just making it up. They can say whatever they want because they're playing a finite game. And if you look at the players who play to perpetuate, they frustrate the heck out of the finite players, right? So the Costcos and the Apples and all of these companies that are people focused, you know, the CEO of Costco, or the founder rather, he's not the CEO anymore, Jim Senegal, he talks about how Wall Street is in the business of figuring out who can make money by next Tuesday. He says we're in the business of keeping our business running for the next 50 years, you know. And so in what always happens invariably is the infinite player frustrates the finite player because one is fighting to win and the other one is fighting to advance. I'll give you one more story that perfectly captures what I'm talking about. So I spoke at an education summit at Microsoft, and I also spoke at an education summit at Apple. At the Microsoft summit, I would say 70% of the executives spent 70% of their presentations talking about how to beat Apple, right? When I was at Apple, 100% of the executives spent 100% of their presentations talking about how to help teachers teach and how to help students learn, right? One was fighting to beat a competitor. The other one was fighting to advance a cause. One was finite and one was infinite. And so at the end of my talk at Microsoft, they gave me a present. They gave me the new Zune. This was their answer to the iPod Touch back when that was a thing, right? And I got to tell you, this thing was spectacular. It was the most incredible piece of technology. The user interface was amazing. The design was incredible. It was so easy to use. It was unbelievable. It was way better than my iPod Touch. So I'm sitting in the back of a taxi with a very senior Apple executive, sort of employee number 12 kind of guy. And I decide to stir the pot. And I turn to him and say, you know, I was at Microsoft and they gave me their new Zune. And I got to tell you, it is so much better than your iOS. And he turns to me and he says, I have no doubt. That's it. Conversation over. Because the infinite player understands that sometimes you're ahead and sometimes you're behind. But they're not playing for the short game. They're playing for the long game.
Does that mean that they're not playing to improve the iTunes interface, which is so frustrating right now?
So I agree with you. It is, I agree with you. iTunes is the weakness in Apple's portfolio.
That's very true.
But the difference is a finite player is trying to beat everyone else.
Right.
An infinite player is trying to advance themselves. They want to be better than themselves rather than better than everyone else. In so doing, they will be better than everyone else, but that's not their drive.
So what obstacles are you currently facing? We've talked about a lot of advancement, but what blockages do you currently have in your work right now?
You know, the same thing that keeps me rigorous as a student is also the thing that I struggle with. I am my own worst enemy. And sometimes it's my own shortcomings or stubbornness or short-sightedness or impatience that can derail something that's going decently. And one of the things that I continue to learn every day and hopefully am improving is how to get out of the way of my amazing team. And sometimes I swoop in, and because I have a little seniority, I forget that I can upset an entire apple cart, not because I wanted to, but because I was insecure about something or because what they're doing plays to my weaknesses, you know? And when you know, I'm good with vision stuff, but I'm not very good at sort of building structure. And so when I don't understand something, I can sometimes become a little bit overly involved. So I'm better than I used to be, but there's still a lot of room for improvement.
What practical things have you, you know, done or put in place, or is it just, you know, is it just that noticing it and trying to do that? Like, is there anything practical you put in place?
It's like any addiction. You know, you can't trust your willpower. You're not strong enough. So of course you need systems in place, you know? So one of the things that I did is I took a deep breath and sort of let myself not be involved. And so the team has regular meetings and regular phone calls about the process and advancement of a particular project, and I'm not in those meetings. And it's proved to be incredibly helpful. And what I've learned is by staying out of it, they're amazing. They are amazing, and they don't need me. And they come to me when they think that I can offer value, but I let them be. And it took a deep breath to do it. But it's been an amazing thing to watch my incredible team flourish and grow and grow themselves. You know, they're all much better leaders because I'm not there.
I have to imagine that it's freeing to you as well, because if you're not there, it means you are doing other things that maybe you're more well suited to do. You enjoy doing more. So it's sort of a mutually beneficial thing, it sounds like.
And that's 100% correct. And Kim, my CEO, she says that to me point blank. She says, I need you to go somewhere else and revel in who you are because you're not, A, you don't enjoy this. And B, when you're here, we don't enjoy you, you know? And so go do something where you will enjoy yourself and be productive and valuable. And by the way, we need you to do that because it helps advance our movement and our cause. And so go play to your strengths and we'll take care of the rest of it, you know? So the team has been, I couldn't have done this without their support. They've been absolutely complicit in it. And it's been an amazing thing to experience. I think a lot of entrepreneurs struggle with letting go. And it doesn't always go right. And you can't swoop in and say, I see, I told you so. You swoop in and say, okay, guys, let me see if I can help you fix it. And then I'll leave again, you know? So it did not happen in a month or two. It's taken a lot of time. But it's such a great place to get to if you can get there.
So what does leadership development look like in your organization?
So we have a lot of coaching that happens, a lot of coaching. There's a lot of individual one-on-one where people are assigned to take care of each other and sort of working with people to work through their challenges and issues and opportunities. We tend to be very good at addressing tensions very quickly. And so if there's tension in a meeting, as soon as everybody hangs up the phone or walks out of the room, immediately someone will pick up the phone and say, hey, you good? What happened there? You weren't your usual self. Or did I say something that offended you because you got really quiet, you know? Or, you know, we tend to be really good at coaching and addressing issues as quickly as possible so it doesn't fester and grow.
That sounds remarkably healthy and not very common. I had just a broader question about your organization, just about the specific kinds of things that you do. This is a bit of a chance for you to highlight some of the things you're working on and maybe some of the things you offer to other organizations. But what are some of the projects that you guys are invested in right now?
Oh, yeah, sure. So we have something on our website called Why Discovery Course. Again, my amazing team took the process that I would do personally with people and companies, and they put a whole thing online to help individuals and small businesses find their own why. It's an amazing, amazing product. I'm so proud of it. And I could never have done it. They did it. So we have the Start With Why course, and we've got lots of free resources available there as well. We've got an entire team of people who can come into a company, not only help them of any size, not only help them discover their why, but actually take them through the steps on how to implement it. We have a whole bunch of new books coming out. There's a follow-up on Start With Why called Find Your Why, and another one called Live Your Why. And we have a quote book coming out this September as well, and a version of Start With Why for kids, for 12 to 16-year-olds, which I'm so excited about. And I'm writing a book about finite and infinite games because I'm so fascinated by it.
That's the one I was hoping to hear.
Yep.
Exactly. Me too.
It's being written and I'm writing it.
When's the... okay, so the follow-up to Start With Why, also I'm very interested in. When does that hit?
The Find Your Why is slated to come out in December.
Sweet.
All right. Merry Christmas to me. Well, let's move on to our fourth question. And this is we're going from a little bit more organizational to a little bit more personal. And the question, the way we phrased it is, what does leadership in your home look like? So that could be self-leadership, family leadership, but just leadership at home. What does it look like when you take it from organization and take it home with you?
Yeah. So it's the practice of considering the people around me even before myself, and doing some simple things that I recommend in offices at home as well. So I recommend never having a cell phone in a conference room, right? Because we're supposed to, in between, you know, the meetings and even when if you're waiting for Bob to show up, because Bob's 10 minutes late, and we're just sitting around on our phones waiting for the meeting to start, what we're missing is an opportunity to build trust and cooperation. Because trust and cooperation, like any relationship, is built up over time with lots and lots of small events. And so it's the small talk. Hey, heard your mom was in hospital. How's she doing? You know, hey, whatever happened with that project you're working on and that client you were talking to? Those conversations and the interest we show in each other's lives are really, really, really important. And so I've tried to do that back home now. So my girlfriend and I will go out for dinner and we'll both leave our phones at home, or we'll bring just one phone in case we need to, like, you know, get a car home or something, or, you know, look something up, a movie or something. But we are very, very good about not having our phones on the table when we're together, or even having them out at all when we go out. And just little things of considering the life of someone else. You know, instead of making unilateral decisions, you know, checking in and saying, hey, I'm thinking about, you know, doing this on Saturday, or that we should do this on Saturday. What do you think? As opposed to just booking and announcing that this has happened. So taking a lot of the stuff that I've learned from preaching about leadership back into the relationship, and it's been really helpful and really remarkable.
What's been the biggest benefit of that practice of distancing yourself from the prison of the cell phone, leaving it behind when you go out to dinner, charging it elsewhere? Just what are some of the practical day-to-day benefits you see of that? Because that's something that I feel like my conscience is pricked when I hear that, but I've never actually taken the step to do that.
Right. And if you have your cell phone on the dinner table with your kids, how dare you? Because you're setting the example. And so we can't tell them that they're always on their phones if we're always on ours, you know?
Right. Yes.
The practical things are I'm the addiction is under control. Like, I don't, when my phone buzzes or beeps and it's on the other side of the room, I don't rush over to get it. You know, like, I'll get it when I get it. I've turned off all the notifications on my phone except for texts and calls, but I don't get any notifications for emails or Instagram or anything. So I have no craving. I'll find out when I check in, you know, I'll find out how many emails I have when I open my email. And so what ends up happening is I can focus and concentrate on something without the itch or urge to check, or even respond to the biz, the bing, the buzz, the flash, and the beep, like Pavlov's dog, you know? And so I can engage in deep thought without distraction a lot better. It's been kind of amazing to feel like you have control over it as opposed to it having control of you.
Well, I think I do want to continue to move along. And the last question that we have is pretty much always my favorite. And it is, what would you tell your 20-year-old self if you could, you know, kind of go back and talk to yourself? What would you tell your 20-year-old self? What advice would you?
I know the answer to this. I would tell myself, you don't have to know all the answers. And when you don't have to pretend you do.
That's something I still need to hear, actually.
I know. I think every leader does, because, you know, what we've been told, the lie that we've been told is leadership is knowing the answer.
Correct. And I wish I learned that lesson earlier. It's been profoundly valuable to me later in life, but I wish I knew that earlier. And it was never an ego play. It's not like I wanted to prove to people how smart I was. It was, you know, I would sit in senior meetings as a junior kid and offer all this additional information because I wanted to, you know, I wanted to help. Or if somebody asked me what's going on, I thought it was smarter to tell them most of the truth because I didn't want them to worry, you know? I remember I was sitting in a meeting where that happened. I was a junior kid in a senior meeting, and I was offering all this additional information because they kept leaving it out. And I knew more because I was the one actually working on the account on a day-to-day basis. And it was, you know, I wasn't trying to upstage anybody. I just knew more. And as we walked out of the meeting, my work mom, one of the senior partners who's sort of like was my mom at work, she put her arm around me as we walked out of the meeting, and she said, 3/4 of an answer is better than an answer and a half.
more is not always more.
Right. That's, and so to this day, I'll sit in meetings where they have most of the answer, but I could definitely offer a little bit more perspective and help out. And I will literally say to myself, it's fine. 3/4 is fine. And you see this all the time in meetings where everybody has to have their say to add just a tiny few more sprinkles on top of the cake, you know?
Yes. And I think, like you said, I feel like it does oftentimes, I mean, sometimes it's an ego trip. People want to prove their intellect or their knowledge base or whatever. But sometimes it is just they feel like 100%, yeah. if you can get to an answer and a half, more is better, right? I mean, that's sort of the default gut feel.
Yeah. Or you left something out. Let me fill it in. I don't, you know, sometimes it is an ego thing, but I'll give people the benefit of the doubt that most of the time they're generally trying to advance the argument or the conversation. The problem is you spend half an hour talking about the same thing and you never get to question number two. And at the end of the day, it really doesn't help. It really doesn't advance.
It really doesn't. One of the things that I think is important to pull out of the conversation that we have had with you today is the leadership lies that you have chosen not to believe. For instance, it is the fact that you say, you know what, my team is actually better off without me. They're actually smarter than I am at things. I am better off. They're better off, and our organization is better off if I just let them run. Nobody ever gets fired for having a rock star team. And that's something that comes up on here from time to time. But I think it's important to point out again.
And I unfairly get all the credit for their amazing work. You know, I think leaders forget that, which is if you let your team run and you let them thrive, don't worry, you'll still get the credit. Like if that's your thing, you know.
But you should, as you have done vocally and consistently throughout this, it's much better if you pass the credit back.
I think one of the responsibilities of leadership. I think one of the criteria, of being a leader. Is that when everything goes right, you have to distribute the credit. And when everything goes wrong, you have to take all the responsibility.
Yeah.
It's just one of the hard things about being a leader. You know, that's one of the things that goes with the territory.
Well, Simon, I think that's probably a good place to land this. Absolutely. I know that, you know, we for time's sake, and then also, we always like to leave with a really strong finish, and you just gave us one. So I think we will wrap this right here. We really appreciate you taking the time to come on with us. Can you just tell listeners where the best place to find your books, your coaching, all of the things you're doing? Is it startwithwhy.com? Is that the best place to go?
startwithwhy.com is definitely a hub, and the Why Discovery course that I told you about before, mm-hmm. that is located at startwithwhy.com. I'm in all the normal social media places, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, blah-de-blah. And books are found at fine bookstores everywhere and some not so fine bookstores as well.
And you're not picky about which bookstore they pick it up.
No, not really. I mean, I like, you know, whatever's convenient and works for whatever. Yeah, it's good.
All right. Thanks so much, Simon. And for you listeners, thanks so much for tuning in. If you would take a moment when you, as soon as you sign off, to jump on iTunes and leave us a rating and review, if you can find your way around that iTunes interface, we would really appreciate it. It helps other leaders like yourself find this podcast. So thanks so much for listening, and tune in next time.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. As you go, don't forget to visit myleadershippipeline.com to learn more about our upcoming Pipeline conference. It will be on October 13th in Nashville, Tennessee, and early bird pricing runs through July, so move quickly to register. Again, that website is myleadershippipeline.com. We look forward to seeing you there.